Yeah.
The most interesting thing that you cover in the book in great detail is how you begin to like pull this information out. You mentioned earlier, but it's worth noting that the name of your company is Black Swan.
Right.
And the whole idea of it's the unknown unknowns.
The tiny little things that make all the difference. Yeah.
And so how do you get to that?
Well, yeah. Again, what are you listening for? Now I know what to tell you to look for. You know, look for the hints of loss. You know, what impacted their identity? Look for the narratives.
That they're telling themselves?
That they're telling themselves. You know, how does this make sense to them? You know, what's the trigger here?
What's the opening question? Do you have a standard opening question that you ask them to get them to start talking?
Yeah, you know, one of a couple things, which is like how every negotiation should go. Script out your first two or three lines, and then you're into an ad lib from that point on. You got to prepared. It's a dance. Let the other person lead. And they'll take you where you want to go. Give them a chance. And the opening is going to be some catch them off guard and expression of concern for them. And we used to talk about this all the time. Like, what's your opening line? And we would go back and forth on a lot of stuff. For the longest time, my favorite was, I'm here to talk to you about coming out. Knowing that they're going to respond, I ain't coming out. Now, my next line, which, and that's all I'm scripted, is, I know you're not coming out now. I just want you to know that when you do, we're going to make sure that you feel treated with dignity and respect, and I got to make sure you don't get hurt. And now we're off to the races, wherever he wants to go. But I put a vision in his head with that statement. It doesn't matter what he says. It's that I got a chance to draw that picture. And then a buddy of mine, super talented guy, Vince D'Alfonso. He says, I want to call in and say, are you okay? Because they're expecting us to call in and ask about the hostages. But are you okay? Now, I'm in a confrontation in a parking lot here in LA about 2 months ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Just on a personal level?
Yeah.
Okay.
And this guy honks at me. You know, he's clearly bent out of shape. And, I'm not being aggressive. And I'm in a parking lot. And I happen to be standing. I think I'm out of his way, but he wants to park where I am. And he honks at me, and he drives by me. He happens to be a black dude. Doesn't really matter. And he's running his mouth as he goes by. And it clearly something has got him wound up before he ever saw me. And for whatever reason, I'm there at the wrong time. Now, I ain't letting this pass. And I'm also not getting into a fight with this guy.
You're not letting it pass that he honked at you and was aggressive?
And he's running his mouth as he goes by. You know, he's about 5-6 feet away. And as it turns out, we're both headed to the same restaurant anyway. But I'm like, I'm just in a mood like, I'm not the type to let this pass for a whole variety of reasons. So, of course, I walk right over to his car. And as he's getting out and he's glaring at me, I'm like, are you okay? He goes, yeah, of course I'm okay. You're in my way. I said, yeah, no, seriously. Are you okay? And he was so caught off guard by that it initially deactivated him. He said, yeah, well, you know, I'm trying to park. You know, you're in the way. I'm like, yeah, man. Oh, man, I'm so sorry. That was stupid of me. I was trying to look at the front of the store to make sure I was at the right place. And now he's come down about halfway. You know, he's clearly coming down. And like, again, this dude has been triggered by something that he's carrying inside him before I'm even on the scene. And I'm not going to aggravate this. So we both, of course, we both head to the same restaurant door at the same time. So I go to hold the door for him. And he picks up his phone and acts like he's not going in. He is not going to accept a gesture of kindness from me.
Right.
And then I go inside and, you know, my girlfriend is there and she's like, is everything okay? You know, what did we do wrong? And he's like, oh, you guys didn't do anything wrong. And so he lurks outside the restaurant till I'm getting ready to leave, but decides to come in at the same time that I'm leaving because it's a takeout. And I go to hold the door for him the second time. And he walks through. So he goes from being combative and calling me names and refusing to walk through the door when I'm being polite and not accepting a gesture of kindness from me, to now I haven't been combative, but I kind of have been confrontive, but confronted him about, is he okay? Are you okay? Are you okay? And saying it in a way where I genuinely meant it. When I get ready to leave the second time, he's good with accepting a gesture of goodwill from me. I hold the door and he comes through.
All right. So from a technique standpoint, you knock him off guard by asking him if he's okay.
And be genuinely concerned and let it come across in my voice. Because I didn't plant that anger in him. I inadvertently added to it. But he rolled into this. There's a phrase that I've seen, which is like, if you understood half the stuff that people are struggling with, you take it a lot easier on them. Like, this dude is struggling with something before he shows up. It's a nice car. I'm judging from his demeanor. Even though he's a black guy, he's a white collar dude. He's in a nice car. As I recall, it was a nice Jeep. Everything about him is just like another regular guy making probably a pretty good living, and something is eating him up before he even shows up there. And I happen to be there at the moment when inadvertently, I add to it by standing in his way.
So for you, the idea of not letting it go, you confronted him, like you said, but it wasn't, is there emotional gratification to you just to engage? You said, I'm not going to let it go for a whole host of reasons. So now right. I need to understand, what reasons are those? Did that feel like an affront to you in some way? And now you just need to engage. You need to lower his anger, and that gives you the sense of justice. I'm not sure. Because if you had gone up to him and been like, listen, asshole, that I would understand. Dumb, but I would understand.
Or what's your problem?
Yeah, but are you looking for emotional catharsis in the confrontation? And is it catharsis that you get by helping him come down?
Well, I can promise you that this is mostly selfish.
Okay.
There's almost a joke out there, the myth of altruism. You're not helping people because you care about people. You help them because it makes you feel good. Therefore, it's very selfish to be altruistic. Sure. So you get into a whole circular argument over all this and knock yourself out unnecessarily. So it does make me feel good to help somebody out. So yeah, I feel genuinely better about it. Part of my philosophy is life. I didn't invent this phrase, leave people better than you found them. You ain't making a world a better place. I'm also a very strong believer in karma. The more positive stuff I do, the more positive stuff comes back to me. I think there's more and more reason to believe that there's something to this energy feeling karma. There's probably science behind karma, and it probably in fact impacts how people react to us and what comes our direction and what we repel. You put out positivity, you're going to attract positivity. I'm also naturally born assertive type. Somebody runs their mouth at me, I'm not good at letting that go. I'm also not interested in making it worse. What's that? You make a speech when you're angry, it's the greatest speech you'll ever regret. I'm not looking to make it worse. And I know that, if I got my negotiator hat on, I'm going to leave this guy better off. And probably in that particular moment, I've talked my way out of confrontations that I did not start other times. I've talked people out of confrontations that I've seen in public that I had nothing to do with. Because I just didn't want to see him go down the tubes.
How do you do that? When somebody's hyped up, they feel an injustice has been done, what's the path to helping them out of that?
I'm on a train in Jersey on a Saturday morning a couple years ago. And a bunch of regular folks on a PATH train headed into Manhattan. And I see this, again, and skin color's got nothing to do with it. It could be Irish, could be Jewish. They're just human beings. See what looks to be like a basically a hardworking blue-collar black guy sitting on a train. Another hardworking, decent human being, black female, sits down next to him. I mean, just slams in onto the. There's like about 6 inches. She plants herself, shoves him forcefully to the side, and says, "I said, excuse me, move over." And I see this poor guy. He's just sitting there minding his own business. Probably struggling with whatever he's doing. And I can see her pushing him. And she's got something she's struggling with on a completely separate. And I can see this getting ready to go bad. Because at some point, I'm on the other side of the car. At some point in time, he's going to get pushed to his limit. Because he was sitting there minding his own business. And no matter how he reacts, unless he gets up and walks away, he's going down over it. There ain't no excuse for pushing back physically with a female under any circumstances. Legally, morally, however you look at it. And I'm looking at this poor bastard and I'm thinking like, I don't want to see this guy go down. So I walk across the train and I lead with, I'm sorry. And when I'm sorry is the first thing out of your mouth, it startles people in a really good way. Like, what are you sorry for? And I'm going to personalize myself. I go, I'm sorry, I'm Chris. And I hold out my hand, which he refuses to take. And he snaps back, Chris, I'm not looking to meet you, Chris. Now, in point of fact, he has met me. He's using my first name. I went from being this bozo on the other side of the train to Chris. And I said, look, man, I just don't want to see anything bad happen to you. That's all. And I go back to the other side of the train. And I can see the wheels in his head turning a completely different way. And I can see from the look on his face, he's thinking like, this is stupid. This is just dumb. And he sits there for a few more seconds and he gets up. He doesn't stand at the ward and he crosses a car to get away from this girl. And that was it. You know, two people living their lives, being triggered by something, got nothing to do with one another, and a potential conversation between just two regular people getting ready to go bad. He just needed an intervention to rethink what was going on.
So did that work because of the idea of trying to, so you talk about Daniel Kahneman and thinking fast and thinking slow, and you're trying to shock him out of
right.
the sort of emotional moment and get yeah. him to think more deeply about the situation?
I'm definitely looking for a thought pattern interrupt that's not where I'm not threatening. And I'm trying to trigger an emotional moment, which very much as you talked about earlier, triggering the brain chemistry, the neurochemicals. We got to get some different neurochemicals coursing through the brain. Get somebody thinking again. Because like if you were to think about that dispassionately, if somebody's a jerk to me in public, which I didn't do anything to cause it, like this person walked into this situation by being eaten up by their own amygdala before I even got here. Mm-hmm. Something else been triggering them. They're struggling with something. If I were to completely understand, I'd walk away. And you need to get somebody in that mindset. Like I didn't do anything wrong. This person's bent out of shape. You know, they're struggling with something. If they had time to tell me, I might give money. But instead, it's turned into a confrontational thing. In a moment, the negative neurochemicals are triggering them. And again, if you make a speech when you're angry, it's the greatest speech you'll ever regret. You don't do smart stuff when you're mad.
Very true. But you have said that if you can control the anger, that it can actually be useful in a negotiation. And I'd
if
love
you
to
can
know,
trigger it to a higher level.
What does that mean?
Well, anger, and this is what a lot of people miss about anger. Like if you've been shattered, if you're fragile, if you're laying on the floor and you can't get up, if you're in the depths of sadness, anger will get you out of it in a heartbeat. And I've actually used it some in the past. If something has made me incredibly deeply sad, loss of a loved one, I pulled myself out of it and I can feel the neurochemical change by thinking of somebody I'm really mad at or someone or something that has made me intensely angry. And I'm instantly lifted out of sadness, grief, despair. The problem that most people don't see is that doesn't lift you to your highest level of performance. Like on a grading scale of A to F, like if you're in the F emotionally, anger will instantly bring you up to a C-level performance, maybe even B-. Now, you won't know how much more room there is at the top. All you know is in comparison, the anger pulled you out of your depths. So you're capable of much more, but if you got no way of knowing that. You don't know that the next level up is the state of flow is human beings' highest performance level. Stephen Kotler's got a lot of research on it. People are doing stuff that they should not be able to do just because they've gotten into flow. That's highly positive. There ain't no anger in flow. Flow is highly positive. It's borderline euphoria. You know, Evel Knievel crashed his motorcycle trying to jump the fountain at Caesar's Palace in 1970-something. Mike, can't think of Mike's last name, before they tore the fountain down, an X Games athlete does a backflip on his motorcycle over Caesar's Palace fountain. Flow. What are you capable of in flow? The first kid, and I, again, it's in Kotler's book, The Rise of Superman, who jumped the Great Wall of China on a skateboard.
Danny Way.
Did it with a broken ankle.
Crazy.
Because he was in flow. Not only did he do it with a broken, he did it several times that day. He was in flow. Nobody had ever done that before, and he did it with injuries that should have put anybody else, you know, in a hospital bed. But he's in flow. It's highly positive. So we don't know that if the anger has lifted us out of our depths. You can lift yourself out of the depths with anger. You probably can't lift yourself out of the depths as quickly with a positive emotion. So that, you know, there's a sequencing, there's a staging there. But you cannot get to your peak performance in a negative state of mind. And anger is a negative state of mind.
So as somebody who knows the power of emotional control, how do you get to your ideal state of mind? I've read
The
Rise, thank you. Stephen Kotler's book, I've read that. I'm very familiar with the ideas that he puts out around flow. But let's say that we're in a negotiating situation, our anxiety spikes massively, or we're in a big confrontation in a parking lot, anxiety's up. How do you bring that down, recenter, and get to your best self?
You know, some of the mantras that you were talking about, you know, who am I? Remember who you are. That's a great mantra. There has to be some preparation in advance. You know, and then you have to have found some success with it. You know, you're not going to try anything if you haven't applied it successfully. You're not going to try it when it's really important if you haven't applied it when the stakes are low. It's like, so what are you doing first thing in the morning? You know, am I lucky to be up or, oh God, is it another day? Is a day a gift? What's the difference between adventure and ordeal? Only the way that you perceive it. I threw that out on my Instagram a couple of months back. You know, what's the difference between adventure and ordeal, or stress and stimulation? You know, and I got a bunch of stress is cortisol. You know, people want to give me that. I know the neuroscience. The answer is how you filter it completely. You know, how do you look at it? Is it happening for you or to you? Are you lucky to be here or you're unlucky? I'm in a negotiation a couple of years ago with somebody whose values I detested. And thinking about this person made me angry every time.
Is this hostage or business?
Business negotiation.
But you
person,
still
person was a liar. Person lied, had no problem lying. And, I got an ex-girlfriend that once said to me, you'd sooner get your arm torn off than tell me a lie. And I remember thinking at the time, well, the words I find highly complimentary, but the way that you said it makes it sound like an insult. Like that's, you know, yeah, but wait a minute, you said that like it's a bad thing. So integrity is really important to me. So when I deal with somebody who lacks it, they're going to trigger me. And if they're triggering me negatively, I'm having trouble prepping for the conversation because I'm dumber when I'm angry. And then I remember the only reason this person is persistent in these negotiations is because my company is a success. And in point of fact, I'm lucky to be in this conversation. And as soon as I did that, I reframed it. I was like, I instantly found myself in a different frame of mind. So, you know, you got to find a phrase. Tony Robbins says, I think he's the guy that said, you know, does life happen for you or to you? Life is happening for you. Like, wow, I don't have to do this. I get to do this. You know, however do you reframe that which takes some practice. Pick out your phrase. Practice it up a little bit, because your negative circuitry is going to kick in. The default circuitry for human beings is negative.
Interesting.
We inherited from the caveman, and the optimistic caveman got eaten by the saber tooth, and the negative pessimistic caveman made a run for it or killed it. But the optimistic guy was like, I got this thing, it just needs
how
a hug.
How hard could it be?
How hard could it be? Just needs a hug. Yeah, so the negative caveman, we're gifted with the wiring of our ancestors, and the negative guy survived.
It's interesting how much you've leveraged an understanding of human nature to get people where you want to go.
So let's start with talking about mastering the no. This is letting them hear no, letting them feel no, without actually saying the words no. And so for your best results, it's going to be tactical empathy on the front end, and then however you're going to say no. And we'll talk about the four phases of no in a later session. But you're letting them hear it, letting them feel it without you actually saying it. Ned Colletti used to manage the Dodgers back in the day. And he was famous for saying, I like to let out no a little bit at a time. And so we're going to talk about ways to actually push back against the other side without cornering themselves and without cornering you. Mastering their weaknesses, their weaknesses. Where do you think the cutthroat's weakness lies?
Not having control.
That's one of them. They need to feel like they're in control. The assertives, the cutthroat negotiators, are looked upon as some of the most difficult people to deal with in a difficult conversation and negotiation. From my perspective, they're the easiest because they want to feel like they're in control. And they want to feel like they got the best deal that they could. The operative word in both of those is feel. Yeah, Chris tells a story all the time about being in the international kidnapping market and the powers that be wanting to know when are they going to release the kidnapped victim. And Chris's standard response was when they feel like they've gotten everything that they could, when they feel like they got the best price possible. Doesn't mean that they actually end up with the best price possible. They just need to feel like they did. And so we're talking about feelings. And how stupid is that when you're talking about international kidnappers and terrorists? We're talking about how they feel. And so our job is to make them feel in control as early as possible, using deference, using subordination. You may even want to say, you know, it's clear that you've got the upper hand here. It's clear that you're in control here. They'll eat it up. They'll eat it up. You try it one time when you go into an area, a space in your organization where you don't have the same cachet as you do in your own, but you bring to the table a special knowledge or skill or ability that's going to help this other space improve their ability to do their job. And when you come in there, you're viewed as an interloper, you're viewed as an outsider. And so as a result, you'll likely get pushback for any idea, any suggestion that you make, because it's not your area and you're encroaching. And the sooner you recognize that and defer to that, the more cooperation and non-obligatory buy-in you'll get from the other side.
All right, guys, we're going to talk about inflection today, tonality. Now, I realize that you're thinking right now, and that's just really mundane stuff. But the mastery level, the black belt skill level here, is in a slight, subtle touch that makes all the difference in the world. And it's at the end of a statement that you really want to land well, where it inflects up.
almost as if it was a question. That makes sure that something that's really important that you have to land is going to land without causing them to get their guard up. I'll give you an example. We're in a training session and we're telling people that labeling a negative in advance doesn't plant a negative. Now, this scares a lot of people. So we tell them about it theoretically and they say, okay, you know, it kind of goes sort of past them. But then when we talk about actually doing it, it scares them. So we go through it and we say, all right, we want you to label these negatives in advance. They go, oh, no, 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 I can't do that. That'll plant a negative. Now, we've told them earlier that it doesn't, and I've got to remind them of that, but gently. Now, I could say, so when we told you earlier that labeling a negative in advance doesn't plant it, you thought we were wrong. Now, my tone of voice inflecting down is kind of harsh, and there's a pretty good chance that saying it like that may cause it to land hard and cause their guard to be up. And I don't need their guard to be up. So instead, I need to say it. So when we told you before that labeling a negative in advance doesn't plant a negative, you thought we were wrong? Now saying it like that the second time makes sure it lands. I could say you thought I was wrong, as if I think you're wrong. Or can say, you thought I was wrong? As if I'm genuinely questioning. I said it the second way, and the person we were teaching said, oh, no, I guess not. And that's exactly the way I needed it to land. So tonality at the end ensures that what you have land will land the way you want it to, so that they think about it. It triggers the thought pattern that you want it to think, and it doesn't cause their guard to come up. Inflecting up at the end is a master negotiator move and mastery of tonality.
I think I'm a terrible negotiator, so let's start with that. Right. We will definitely today cover some of the principles of that, but what I really want to talk about is in the book, when you're talking about some of the scenarios that you were in, where people, it's a life and death situation,
right?
And you're the line of defense. How do you deal with that emotionally? Like, that's, my job feels high stress, but that's, no one's life is on the line. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, well, there's a couple things. I mean, first of all, you just don't know any better.
Maybe when you first started, but not long-term.
You know, training in the FBI, they started out really good. I mean, they hit you. You know, with the Tyson line, everybody has a plan until they get punched. Like the second day of the negotiation training, the FBI, they hit you square between the eyes with something really hard.
Like a real story or something?
Yeah. You know, they spend the first day laying out a philosophy, which if you understand the nuances of the words, I still completely agree with. A hostage has never been killed on deadline in the United States, ever. And so, like, you get kind of comfortable and you got a sense that negotiation's pretty successful overall. I mean, in reality, it's about a 93% success rate.
Whoa.
And then the very next day, they present a scenario where it looks like a hostage got murdered right on deadline, right in front of everybody. And you just, like, I mean, you were hit in the head.
Can I use the words you use in the book? Because this was when I realized I don't want your job or the one that you had back then. You said she was shot twice in the back with a shotgun.
Right.
It almost cut her in half.
Yeah.
As she flew through the glass window.
Yeah,
and I thought, God damn.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I'd find a way. But, Chris, I don't know how I'd come back from that. Like, that would damage me in ways that I can't imagine.
Well, that ends up kind of getting into a secondary characteristic, because then when I was running a program, I went out of my way to look for negotiators that had been involved in a siege where somebody gotten killed. And they bounce back.
Mm.
You know, typically with a success rate that's that high, if anytime you're under less than double digits of a job, sieges, whatever you want to call them, probably everything you touch is going to turn out good and you're going to get a little overconfident. And once you start climbing past double digits, I mean, odds are starting to run against you. And what happens with pretty much every time is the negotiator will be like, you know, I didn't get into this to watch people die. I'm going to find another thing to do. Or they're going to say, I'm never going to let this happen again. And those people will double down and they'll be more courageous in speaking truth to command, whether it be an ambassador or an on-scene commander, and basically saying, like, no, we can't do it like this. I don't care what you think.
Were you ever involved in an operation where somebody got killed?
Yeah.
So did you need to put yourself back together, or do you not react like that? Let's start with that question.
I've been repeating one phrase in my head for a long time leading up to that I didn't really realize what it meant. My old boss, Gary Nessner, used to always teach us best chance of success. What we're doing is the best chance of success. And so then when the Burnham Sobrero case in the Philippines, a lot of people got killed. And finally,
can you give us a quick breakdown what happened?
Gracia and Martin Burnham and another American citizen named Guillermo Sobrero got scooped up in a dive resort in the Philippines, in a region of the Philippines everybody thought was completely safe. Now, the bad guys, the Abu Sayyaf, were looking for Westerners. There'd been a siege earlier in the same year in another part of the Philippines where they looking for Americans and Westerners. They got nothing but Western Europeans. And they ultimately, that case was a train wreck, which I was not involved in because there were no Americans there. And the bad guys ended up scoring about $20 million as a result.
Oh.
Which made a rival gang jealous of the score. So they go out and they do an even more daring raid. They cross like 400 miles of open ocean on these lousy little boats, scooped everybody up in a dive resort, and ended up getting three Americans and a bunch of Filipinos. Sobrero ends up getting murdered by the terrorists about three-ish weeks in, 21-ish days.
How does the siege go on for that long?
Oh, this thing lasted 13 months. So, oof. Yeah, that was just the beginning. That wasn't even the opening act. So,
and they did they kill them to make a point, to just prove, like, we're serious?
Well, you know, they were Western American arrogance, if you will. When Sobrero finally got killed early on, you know, there had been Filipinos. The bad guys were killing the Filipinos regularly. Like, it was no big deal. And I can remember at that point in time when we tried to stir up a little outrage over it, I thought, you know, we have sat here and not really said much at all while these Filipinos are getting beheaded. Mm. Now all of a sudden we want everybody to be bent out of shape. And I remember thinking, like, if I was a host country, my reaction would be like, oh, now it's important to you? So, but that the group that was doing it at the time, I mean, they were... They did all the bad things that terrorist murderers do. I mean, all of them.
How do you... So, one, was that the first time that you were on a call where somebody got killed?
It was the first kidnapping that I was directly involved in where people were getting killed, yes.
All right, so when the first body shows up, are you the one talking to them?
No, we coached.
Okay.
One of the reasons why, you know, what I'm doing now is applicable. The Black Swan method is based on hostage negotiation, which is universal. Human nature. Everybody's human. So I could show up in any country. I mean, literally any country, any culture, Philippines, Nigeria, Cape Town, Baghdad. All I need to do is find somebody that's coachable. And that person probably knows the market, if you will. And I understand the human wiring. So we put together their knowledge of the market in very general terms and my knowledge of how to get people to engage. And then we can negotiate anywhere.
Hope you enjoyed this episode brought to you by our sponsors at BetterHelp. Go to betterhelp.com/impact to get 10% off your first month. Enjoy the episode.
Okay, so when the first body comes out, what happens to you? It's the first time that this has gone awry. We're in the 7% now that don't go well. It, for me, when I think about the way that that would like impact my mind and force me to like regroup, did it knock you off or are you just laser focused?
Well, you got to keep rolling because the case was still ongoing. And
so no time for emotions right now. Is that what you're telling yourself?
Yeah, kind of, probably. You know, you just, I mean, you got no choice. The case is still going on. You got a team. You want to go fast, go alone. You want to go far, go as a team.
You can always run screaming from the building. But really, and this is where life gets interesting for me, is that by nature, I would say I'm a run screaming from the building person, but I had to flip it all because I don't respect that. And In discovering that you don't respect your initial impulse becomes a fascinating journey if you're willing to walk it. I'm always curious if other people are having to do what I have to do to keep myself centered in there, or if it's just like, nah, it didn't occur to me to run screaming from the building.
Well, when you're in the midst of, you know, when you're in the battle, I mean, you can't bail. I mean, people are looking at you to lead. There are other people's lives that are still on the line.
So that's your identity.
Pick yourself up.
You wouldn't allow yourself to do that.
Probably, yeah.
Okay.
Good.
Did you, because I know you at least have one son.
Yeah.
Did you teach him that? Like, hey, in this family, we don't tuck tail. We don't run. Because what, fight, flee, make friends?
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you have those kind of conversations with him? Because this, like, I don't know how much of this is your character from birth and how much of this is you've built this incredible value system that allows you to be in the most insanely difficult situations on planet Earth. You go into great detail about this in the book, and it's so true. Most people are so uncomfortable with conflict that even when it's asking for a raise or negotiating for a car, they can't do it. They can't sit in that discomfort.
Right.
That's nothing compared to they just dumped a beheaded body at our feet to say, you're not convincing, basically.
Right.
Like, you're not getting anywhere. That's a real life, man. Like, yeah. I can understand why most people would not want to do that. So I'm curious. And I find that asking people how they raise their kids often gets to what they do internally. So what did you teach your son or sons about who we are as a family?
Yeah, I think it was me and my father simultaneously. And, you know, and everybody else is what my mother as well. Because my son, Brandon, who runs my company.
Is the best negotiator, or so I'm told.
He's a star. He's really good. He's basically a Jersey guy, you know, he's mixed race, but he's this bizarre combination of Jersey and Iowa, because we started sending him back to Iowa. My father's a very blue-collar, hard worker, expects you to figure stuff out and get stuff done. We start sending my son back to Iowa in the summertime when he's about six. So he's so comfortable in both worlds that actually back in Iowa, they like to call him Metro Jethro, because he loves it there. He fits in completely. And, you know, he's growing up. He's 8 years old. Grandpa's got him working in the business first half of the day because the town pool doesn't open till noon. So he'd have to get out of bed in the morning and have breakfast with his grandpa or his grandparents. And then he'd have to get on his bike and ride to the same location his grandfather was driving to. But his grandfather wouldn't give him a ride. He's like, look, you get on your bike, you get out there. You're supposed to be there at 8:30. You get yourself out of bed. Get yourself fed. I will see you at the office. And they would leave at approximately the same time. And, you know, he'd be like, why am I not getting a ride? But that was just sort of the way that he grew up with, you know, my parents' help. And then at home, it was always, yeah, you got knocked down, pick yourself up. Mm. He's got a memory from when he was playing football in, he went to fifth year of high school because he was really young. So there was a special program to get him ready for college ball. And he made a great play. He's playing middle linebacker. He hustled all the way across the field, missed the tackle, just barely missed the guy. I mean, phenomenal hustle. Ended up diving through the air, landed on the ground, out of bounds, and put just such effort into it. And he was laying on the ground, and he remembers hearing my voice in the distance go, great hustle. Now get up. And he was like, all right, well, this is the environment I grew up in. So I think it's sort of a family thing that we inherited from my dad. And, you know, my dad picked out a woman that believed in those values, and Brandon's mom believed in hard work. So that's just kind of how he came up.
Yeah, I love that value system. I'm a fan for sure. Okay, so at what point do you start articulating those values out loud? And are you talking about toughness, resilience? Like what is it? Like, I read your book before I saw interviews with you. And so I wasn't expecting the sort of East Coast attitude. And it was then suddenly it asked an interesting question for me, because what I'm trying to tease out is, okay, how much of like the your ability to negotiate is just this like aggressive, tough nut, you know, it's all about being hardcore, and how much of it is learned resilience and strategy?
I'm a little bit of a believer in that pretty much everything is learned. The talent code, Daniel Coyle, I think. Yep. That's that point that he tries to make. That, you know, the human beings that we think are prodigies, they just got interested before anybody noticed. And then, bang, suddenly they were good at it. But they'd been interested in practicing for a while. I think that's pretty close to being true. I wish I could think of his name. A documentary I saw recently on a phenomenally successful music producer picked out the correct key when he was 3 years old, when somebody was cleaning a piano and hit one of the keys. So he probably was born with some extra.
Mm.
But I pretty much think everything is learned. Now, how did my son learn it? Well, right after I left the FBI, I attended a training session. And it was the first time it occurred to me, I remember saying to myself, leading by example is not enough. So I don't think I ever told him anything explicitly. I think myself, you know, his grandfather, we sought lead by example. You know, you want somebody to learn how to do something or to learn how to live, I mean, then set a great example and expect them to pick it up.
So, but if it's not enough, what is the magic formula?
Yeah, great question. Depend upon the age of the human being, you know, probably you gotta find somebody else, hopefully, to mentor them, or you gotta let them find their own way. And it's gonna be messy. And ideally, you've led by example enough till, you know, some that stuff, as you were talking about, the age of imprinting, right? Mm. So by the time they're starting to get into trouble in their mid teens or later, I mean, they're kind of imprinted. You gotta go with whatever you put in them. And then ideally, their mistakes that they're going to have to make, ideally, they're not costly enough where they're crippled for life over it.
But give them some space, make them ride their bike to the pool, pick yourself back up.
Yeah.
Be tough, be resilient, face it. Yeah, I think all that stuff's amazing. Okay, so.
And
now,
you know, and even to take a little bit further, because, you know, and. Taleb's book, Anti-Fragile.
Mm, great book.
Post-traumatic stress growth, right? And then I'm reading an art piece about Cooper Kupp today.
Who?
A receiver for the Rams.
Cooper Kupp.
The guy who set all, he won a triple crown this year. Everybody forgotten that the guy recovered from an ACL tear several years ago. Normally, the end of a football player's effectiveness, if not their career. Like, normally they're never the same. After this traumatic injury, torn ACL, none of these guys are ever the same. Kupp says to himself, this is my opportunity to rebuild myself, get rid of my bad habits, you know,
like I'm already.
Fix what I was ever doing wrong. And Rams are in the Super Bowl, and he won the Triple Crown for receivers. I mean, he's number one in all these categories. And I'm like, wait a minute. He tore his ACL? Nobody comes back from an ACL tear. And I'm reading that, and I'm thinking post-traumatic stress growth. He made the decision not just to recover, but to be better as a result of this massively traumatic injury. That's, you know, that's beyond resilience. That's what Taleb would talk about being anti-fragile.
Yeah, no, I love that. Such a powerful idea that getting hurt can actually make you stronger. But in the human anyway, it comes down to your mindset, how you respond to it. Yeah. So now we're back in the Philippines. The first body just gets dropped off. You obviously decide that you're going to get stronger. You don't want it to happen again. How do you, are you just really good at recentering yourself emotionally? Or is it a meditative practice? Like when the body hits, I know what that would be like for me. That rush of blood to my head where my ears almost feel like they're closing in. You can hear your heartbeat beating in your ears. Did that happen and you had to calm yourself down? Or does that just not happen and you're just so laser focused?
Well, it was principally because we were still in the midst of the siege. There were still two Americans whose lives were at stake. And up to that point in time, the intergovernmental organization was probably at its worst. Like, we had previously gotten through a case and everybody had gotten away with kind of half cooperating, and the bodies hadn't been, the case we just finished just a couple of months earlier, like nobody got killed. And it's a little bit like success. You win, a football analogy again, it's tough for a football team to repeat after they won the Super Bowl because people are a little more focused on their own success versus team success once they reach the pinnacle. So the cooperation in the early part of the second case was horrible. I mean horrible, because they'd gotten away with it previously and there was no body count. But now there was people were dying. So we really had to, we got our arms more around the case. We pushed a little harder on cooperation. People got a little more serious about not cooperating, which in the long run, 12 months later, was when the final round, two out of three remaining Americans got killed in a botched rescue attempt. And the case had gotten really ugly again at that point. Now, that one hit me harder than the first one, because in the first one, nobody had been cooperating with us. So I felt less responsible for the outcome because the government of the Philippines was playing games with us. You know, they felt out of control in the last case. So they gave us a guy who was supposed to handle the negotiations that was just completely going missing in action on a regular basis when he was supposed to be with us. I mean, and they pulled him right after the first series of deaths. They were like, all right, this ain't working out so good. So I felt, we still had the case going and I hadn't gotten my arms wrapped around it that well. Now, 12 months later, I had had my arms wrapped around it. And then when Martin Burnham, when the word came in that he got killed, that hit me. That was a real, I'll never forget that moment. I was at home in the U.S. when I got the call that he'd been killed. That, for me at the time, was difficult. Worst moment of my professional career. One of my worst personal moments until I'm listening to a case a couple years later, listening to a negotiator talk about how hard it was on him when a baby had gotten killed in siege.
Oh, God.
And I remember thinking at the time, and it was a guy I had a tremendous amount of respect for. I thought, hard on you? That wasn't your relative. And then when I thought about that, I thought, and how am I, feeling sorry for myself over Martin Burnham's death because he wasn't my father. He wasn't, my spouse. He wasn't my brother. I got no right feeling bad about this. Or at least to the extent that his family members do. So that, that was a bit of, the overall journey there, putting things in perspective. Like, you asked to be in the middle of this stuff. It's a volunteer job. You're going to feel sorry for yourself when you volunteered. That's probably out of perspective.
Why did you volunteer?
I found myself, I was in crisis response. I was a member of the FBI SWAT team, and I had re-injured my knee, and I wanted to stay in crisis response. I liked crisis response. People got to make up their mind. You can't go, well, let's sleep on this. Let's give us 24 hours to think about it. You can't do that. You got to make a decision. And I've always been in favor of decision making. So I'd been a SWAT guy and we had hostage negotiators, and it was a little bit like what we were talking about earlier. some stuff is a lot harder than it looks from the outside.
Oh, yeah.
And I literally remember thinking to myself, I talk to people every day. I could talk to terrorists. How hard could it be? You know, my son and I joked that the DeVos family motto is, how hard could it be? Which is a little bit like, you know, it's a little bit like the redneck's famous last words. Hey, watch this.
Yeah. Hold my beer.
Hold my beer. So, but then I got into it and I've been volunteering. When I finally got trained, I got volunteered on a suicide hotline. And then when I'm in it, I'm like, I'm around these extraordinary people that are doing phenomenal things with words. I mean, with words, not actual actions, just words. Making a huge difference and being in the middle of these sieges and making a difference simply by what they said. And I thought, now, I could get into this. This could be good. And it was.
And so how does that journey begin of learning what to say? Like, what are the sort of magic words? Like, take us back to the Philippines. The bodies start coming out. How do you talk somebody down like that? Like, it just seems like all hope is lost once they kill the first person. There's no backing out.
Yeah, man, they still got more people that are at stake. And so you can't not communicate. And, you know, it's kind of like any other negotiation where the other side is doing stuff that is just not in their interest, but they're absolutely convinced that they're right. I mean, these guys want to get paid. And negotiation is not what it is to you, it's what it is to the other side. You get all bent out of shape that it's a horrific, horrible thing.
That was something I heard you say, I think in an interview.
Yeah.
So there is no such thing as logical. There's right. only what matters to you.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, that is so true. You literally just cut through decades worth of economics textbooks that try to make people seem rational with that one sentence. That the second I heard you say that, I was like, oh my God, that is absolutely true. There is no such thing as logical. There's only what matters to you.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So is that like when you come into a situation like that, are you just asking yourself what matters to this person?
Yeah.
Is that the most fundamental question? What matters?
Then what matters? And then ultimately people make up their mind principally on what they perceive the loss to be. And that's human nature. Doesn't matter the scenario.
When you say the loss that led them to do this, or what losing in that scenario would look like?
Got to look at both. Loss that drove them to the table in the first place to take the action. And then what loss are they avoiding by the action? And you want to get in their head and find out what it is. And since what loss are they avoiding is all perception, you know, vision of the future, then depending upon how you got in their head, if you're in there by invitation, which is the whole point of empathy or the tactical application of empathy, to get in by invitation. Since you're in there by invitation, then the idea is to get them to look at another loss. So if it's a kidnapping, it's a question that seems as merciless as, how are you going to get paid if you kill people? How are we gonna collaborate? You know, how much are you losing by getting rid of hostages when you could have gotten paid for them? Because somebody's going to scare up the money for the hostage.
Right.
Somebody's going to. A hostage negotiator's real job internationally is to make sure that if somebody scares up that money, that there's enough of a trail left that you can hunt them down afterwards. It's exactly why you give a bank teller bait money. You don't want the bank teller to get shot over money. Now, you also don't want the bank robber to leave the bank with the entire contents of the vault. You give them enough money so the bank teller doesn't get shot, the bad guy leaves, and you chase him down afterwards. That's the way to save lives and put the bad guys out of business. So you want to get them focused back on the money again. And then if they kill more hostages, it's their loss. And that's when they start to think like, all right, well, maybe we made our point. You know, let them feel that way. Who cares how they feel as long as you get what you want? And that's the idea to try to re-engineer the outcome.
That's really interesting.
One of the biggest surprises that I took really to heart in the book was getting to know first, where we're so wired. I mean, we're completely wired for the opposite. For example, on a recruiting call, if I call a typical agent, you know, who doesn't know who I am, I might say, hey, you know, Chris, this is Alex Vidal with Related ISG, blah, blah, blah. How are you doing today? By the way, I see you're a great agent. I was calling to see if you would be interested in learning more about my company. And the typical answer is, no, I'm happy where I'm at. It's a 30-second call.
Right.
I read your book. I sit down with my leadership team. And I say, guys, I want to try something different. Just hang out. I'm going to put it on speaker. So I call Chris. And now Chris answers the phone. And I said, hey, Chris, this is Alex Vidal with Related ISG International Realty. How you doing today? Oh, I'm doing great. How are you? I'm like, oh, man, I'm doing great. I already know you're a great agent, just the fact that you even picked up your phone to begin with. And they start laughing, you know, because in realtors in South Florida never answer their phone. So then I follow up and go, let me ask you a question. Do you want to make less money this year than you did last year? And they say, no. And I'm like, no? No, of course not. Of course I want to make more money this year than I did last year. Oh, it sounds like you want to make this your best year ever. I do. Well, that's why I was calling. I want to show you how my brokerage can help make that happen for you. And I got the no right away. And then you got the no out of the way. And then I followed it up with, you know, the mirroring and the labeling and all that. And it was very interesting. My average recruiting call went from 30 seconds to 10 minutes.
Wow.
And just using that opening line, and I don't care. I'll share it with my competitors. It doesn't really bother me. They're just spewing out information, literally using the mirroring and the labeling. What is it about people's need to want to say no? And what are the benefits of getting that no out of the way first?
Yeah, you know, we're conditioned. There's some conditioning out there that we got to recognize. It's just true.
Yep.
So we've gotten conditioned that every time we say yes, somebody's trying to lead us into a trap. Somebody's trying to get us to say yes. You know, the momentum selling says each yes is a tie down. A tie down takes away our autonomy, a basic human driver of what we are as human beings. Not what we are as males or females, not what we are as Westerners, as human beings. And this is about human wiring. You can't point to a civilization in the history of mankind that was content as slaves. It's driven us since we crawled out of the swamps. So these tie downs take away our autonomy and immediately begin to diminish rapport as we take away somebody's autonomy. And so we've been conditioned that if somebody's trying to get us to say yes, we're under attack. We've also conditioned ourselves is when we say no, we've just protected ourselves. We've just done something to preserve our autonomy. We're safer every time we say no, which is why so many people's default answer is no, not because they thought it through, but they've conditioned themselves, which means they feel safe when they say no. There's a neurochemical response.
Sure.
The chemicals that you feel when you say no make you feel safe and secure. Consequently, you're more willing to listen. Your guard's not up. You've protected yourself. So you start out with that question right away where somebody says no. Then they've just gotten a hit of all the chemicals that make them feel safe. And now they're willing to talk to you. And then your follow-on moves are all designed to make them feel heard, like you're interacting with them instead of against them. I mean, it sounds like you like to make more money. That was based on their response. You instantly prepare yourself to go into a collaborative conversation. Again, they're not threatened. They're not being attacked. They're not under siege. And now it's I'm not the least bit surprised that you're going from 30-second calls to 10-minute calls, because as soon as you preserve the other side's autonomy, now they can talk to you candidly. Plus, you're different than all the other bozos out there that are trying to get them to say yes.
That's it. And you know, the typical answer is, well, I'm happy where I'm at. Oh, it sounds like they take really good care of you. Yeah, they do. Awesome. What is it that they take? You know, maybe I can learn something about I can do in my company. What is it that they do to take care of you? And then you start finding all these holes, and then the wall just keeps coming down. We had a conversion rate of 75% from calls to appointments. It was unbelievable. And that's why I believe so much in the book. I read a lot of books, but Very few make a direct, immediate impact the way yours did.
Just curious. All right, so you got to a conversion rate of 75%. What roughly were you doing before that?
Oh, probably we would get maybe one out of maybe every 6, 7, 8 calls. Maybe we'd get an appointment.
Wow.
And then those appointments had to show up. The fact was, not only were we at a 75% conversion rate, but the bond that we had created with those people during that phone call was so good that they actually showed up for the appointment versus, I don't even have questions about the yeses, but you talk about in your book, the three types of yeses that we get, that we typically get. And so by spending 10 minutes on the phone with them, we actually get the approval action-based yes that moves the ball forward, not just something to get us off the phone.
Interesting.
Hello, Black Swan Negotiators. We're talking about mastery of negotiation skills today. And mastery of negotiation skills comes from, boringly enough, mastery of some of the basics. What are the skills that seems basic from the list of the FBI 8 negotiation skills? There they call it minimal encouragers. The Black Swan group, we call them encouragers. Encouragers are one of those subtle, seemingly basic skills that pay great dividends. They're the little sounds that we make when we're listening to somebody. Yeah, uh-huh, okay, go on. They're very encouraging. The people we're talking with love to be encouraged. That's why we want to use encouragers. They want to know that we're there and we're listening and that we're attentive. Now, of our three types, assertives, analysts, and accommodators, our assertives and our analysts aren't really naturally at encouraging the other to talk. They either want to talk themselves or they want to think. Our accommodators tend to be very good at encouragers because they love to encourage people. Encouragers are essential, especially when we're talking on the phone, but even when we're in person. You want to keep the other person talking. After all, remember, negotiation has often been described as the art of letting the other person have your way. You get them to talk themselves into the deal, and this is one of the ways that you do that. I'll talk a little bit about physical encouragers for when they can see us, whether we're in person with them or whether we happen to be on some sort of video call where they can see us. Principal among those is the head nod. This is fantastic. People love when you nod your head when you're listening to them. It's incredibly encouraging. And I do this for a number of reasons when people can see me. Number one, they love it. Number two, as crazy as it sounds, it'll help you stay awake. Sometimes I do the head nod when I'm having trouble staying awake. I start nodding my head just to keep myself awake. I found as a side benefit, I actually listen a lot better, and the speaker has a tendency to dial into me specifically and feel really good about the fact that it's me that's listening to them. Here's a crazy story. A number of years ago, I was in Beirut with some students when I was going to the Kennedy School of Government and was working on my Master's of Public Administration. We met with the heads of all the political parties while we were there. We were sitting in a meeting with one of the heads of the parties, and because his English wasn't great and his accent was so thick, I couldn't understand almost anything that he said. On top of that, it was a hot day and I was having trouble staying awake. It was in the middle of the afternoon. So while I'm sitting there, I just start nodding my head to everything he says, even though I really can't understand anything he's saying. I'm just nodding away because I was too embarrassed to fall asleep in front of this guy. And as we're all filing out and shaking hands on the way out, he goes out of his way to come up to me and shake my hand and look at me and say, hey, next time you're in Beirut, please make sure you stop by. I absolutely love talking with you. This was all a result of my head nods. Believe me, the listener loves it when you nod yes. Remember, mastery of a skill comes from mastery of the basics.
Where are we in 2021? You're already using a Black Swan method. A number of faces and names I've seen on in our gallery here, the Rogues Gallery of Black Swans. You're already using a Black Swan method. You are somewhere in one of three stages: shu, ha, or ri. Shu is when you're learning, and these are martial arts terms. Some of you may already be
familiar with these. But when you're learning this, or you're learning as different aspects of the approach, at the very beginning, we're going to ask you to do it. And we've been asking you to do it word for word, exactly as we've said, word for word, exactly down to the word. The old Karate Kid movie, wax on, wax off. Now, ha, after you've done enough repetitions, 63 to 67 on a specific word for word, you begin to branch out and understand. Most of you are already part of the community. You're going to start to hear things that other people in the community say that you're going to learn from. Your understanding expands. You don't feel constrained anymore by doing it word for word. You actually feel a sense of freedom, and every now and then you ad-lib a little bit. And then as the reps continue and you continue to branch out and understand, you begin to create your own original rules for the same knowledge. And you go from learning from the community to contributing to the community, to saying things that other people are going to find insightful, which is exactly where we got the rule of gathering data with your eyes. Because when we did one of our challenges recently, Brandon and I were interviewing a couple of people on a call in the middle of the challenge about how far they've gone in their journey on a Black Swan method, and the fact that they're practicing with each other. And it's becoming something that they actually enjoy doing. They enjoy negotiations just for the sake of the negotiations. And one of the guys threw out the phrase, gather data with your eyes. And I went like, holy cow, I love that. I never heard that before. I said, well, you know, that's gorgeous. Where'd you come up with that? He goes, well, you guys probably said it somewhere along the line. Well, I don't think so. Like maybe Brandon said that to him at one point in time. But I don't remember hearing that before. That's where you guys can get to if you look at this, first of all, as a perishable skill. And secondly, the joyful application of these skills.